you who grew up in the Reformed faith, I don't think you always realize how great of a gift that you've been given. I came out of college, my intent was to be a millionaire at 30. That was my intent. And I was on that path. And I was doing quite well, and I think that I probably could have made it. And I was doing a job that I found enjoyable for 2 years. And in the third year, as I walked back into the same classroom again to remodel the same lab on the University of Colorado, and all that was going to change was the colors. Nothing substantial, just the colors, because there was a grant and the guy needed to spend his money, or he lost his grant for the following year. And I started to wonder, I was here last year, and I just did this last year. Why am I doing this? And in the fourth year, I went back into that same lab and did it all again. And I remember thinking, this is a waste of my life. Why am I doing this? I wish at that point that there was somebody around me who had been able to say, hey, work is worship. Let me show you how what you're doing can bring the gospel to a group of people that nobody else will ever be able to touch. Right? The University of Colorado is one of the most secular campuses in America. It's known as one of the most prolific party schools that exists. It is on one side, it's a crazy place. And on another side, it was a wonderful group of people to minister to. And everybody that I talked with around me at that point just reiterated the feelings that I had. This is a waste of your life, Scott. You'll spend the next 20 years going in and remodeling labs, and it will be for things like this, because blue's out and green's cool. Or, I don't like black tiles, and now I want to have red tiles. I wish that somebody had told me that there's work as worship, right? That work can be done for the glory of God, but nobody was able to tell me that at that point. And so I started on a path to figure out, how do I use my life well? And now we understand that God's sovereign and he does great things, right? And he used that to take me to Africa and work on a construction project in a hospital. And that ultimately brought me back to work with college students, which radically shaped the way that I viewed life and what education is and what the purpose of training up a group of people to go back into the world. And then that landed me here, right? And so God's in control all along the way, and he knew what he was doing. But not all of us have been taught the way that some of you were taught, that work is worship. And for those that have heard that lesson, I just want to reiterate that this morning. And for those that are sitting there saying, I've never heard that before, then I hope that as we look at this passage, we can understand what God's talking about. This is the last section in Paul's household code. It's also the last piece. Remember in chapter 5, verse 21, Paul says, submitting to one another out of reverence for Christ. And I had told you at the point when we studied that passage where Paul says in verse 17 or 16, maybe it's 18, that we're supposed to be filled with the Spirit, that he then lists a set of participles about what it means to be filled with the Spirit. And some of that includes singing and making music in your heart, and some of it means being thankful no matter where you are. And the last one that he includes is he says, submitting to one another. That's part of what it means to have a Spirit-filled life. And then Paul immediately jumps in and he starts talking about that in relation to husbands and wives. And he talks about it in relationship to fathers and children or parents and their kids. And then this is the last piece that he picks, right? This is part of what it means to have a Spirit-filled life, is that our work environment between slaves and masters displays the wonderful work that God has done in our heart. That it transforms that environment. Now, for some of us, we read these words and these verses, and we hear slaves and masters, and it immediately conjures up in our mind some picture of 1830s Deep South America with slaveholders and African Americans and a situation of slavery that is horrendous. And certainly this was not to diminish or to play down what happened in America in the first 100 and so years of its life. Absolute, abysmal, atrocious. But that's not the kind of slavery we're talking about. That 200-year period in American history is a horrible caricature of slavery around the globe. There's bad slavery like that still goes on. But in the Roman Empire, the slavery that was happening was very different than that kind of slavery. So I want to correct your view just a little bit so we have an understanding and we see how this is actually really close and parallel to the work and boss relationship. In slavery in the Roman Empire, we have to understand it wasn't racial. This wasn't driven by they have a different skin color or they have a different ethnicity. Anybody could be a slave in the Roman world. Anybody. It also wasn't a permanent status. Every slave could expect that they would be released during their life at some point. Frequently by the time they're 30 years old, that they would be set free. So it was a temporary setup. It involved totally different set of occupations than what we think of when we think of the Deep South America 150 years ago, right, where the slaves did the most menial and most difficult and most hard forms of labor. That wasn't the case in Rome. There were some slaves who did work like that, but there were also slaves who managed books. There were slaves who served in the imperial court. There were slaves who traveled for their masters to distant lands and brought home huge amounts of goods, right, that acted as what we would call businessmen, import-exporters. Being a slave meant you could have anything. There were slaves that frequently were more educated than their masters, and the slaves were the ones who took down books and kept records and tracked stuff so that they could give oral reports to their masters who couldn't read and write. To be a slave did not mean that you were at the bottom of life. And in fact, frequently to be a slave meant that you were in process of becoming a full Roman citizen and that it was a path to a better life for you. It's a totally different kind of slavery that we're talking about here. It led to economic advancement. It was a way of getting citizenship. We need to understand that as we look at a passage like this and just say, hey, this has no bearing upon us. The world that I just described of the Greek or the Roman slave is really akin in many ways to the work world that we get up and go to each morning, isn't it? That it's a way of us advancing. It's a way of us finding a better life. It's a way of us achieving something that we want for life. And certainly, the boss is a lot like the slave owner. He has a certain amount of rights to tell you what to do and what not to do and how he wants you to behave and how your work's going to be done and what the end goal is that needs to be accomplished. And you as the slave or as the employee have a responsibility to carry that out for your employer. Freedom was very different in the Roman world. And there were four types of freedom in the ancient world. There was the freedom to act as your own legal person, right? To sign documents yourself, to make your own legal binding contracts that you could enter into. There was the freedom from being seized as property, right? Needing to pay back debts. There was the freedom to earn a living the way you wanted to earn a living. And there was the freedom to move and live where you wanted to move. But in order to be considered a free person in the Roman world, you only needed to have the first kind of freedom, the freedom to enter into a contract yourself. Somebody else could determine everything else in your world, and you would still be considered free if you could sign your own contracts, if you could bind yourself in a business arrangement. Similar again to our world, isn't it? We like to think that we can do all of these things, that we can earn a living however we want, and that we can go and live wherever we want, and we can do whatever we want. But the economics of life functionally puts us in a place where we're a slave, right? We choose to live certain places because that's where the work is, and the work isn't in the place where we want to live, right? We choose to do certain types of work because that's where the money is that we need to earn, and we can't make a living doing the thing that we want to do. And yet we still engage in contractual agreements, right? We sign our name, and we call that freedom. It's very similar to the Roman world. So with that and kind of in the background, right, hopefully we've set the stage, and you say, okay, yeah, I can see this is okay. This is like me. This is like the situation I live in. Let me ask, why does Paul address this relationship? He talked about husbands and wives. He talked about parents and children. Why does he pick this one? You spend half your life here. An immense, it's arguable that you'll spend more time at work than you will with the other relationships that you have in life. This is the most, the next most important place that you have. Once you learn how to love your wife or submit to your husband, once you learn how to raise your children to be emissaries of God, right, to be shining lights for the world, then the next place where you have the most amount of impact and influence is your labor. It's your work. So Paul picked this, I think, because it's the third most important place that you as a Christian will ever be. The person you work for and the people you work with. And he wants to say, let me show you how the Spirit-filled life comes in and touches that place too. I think he chooses this one because there's some things that are kind of perennial, right? They happen all the time, everywhere, no matter where you are. What employee loves his boss? What employee is not cracking jokes at the boss's expense? Right? Any of us that have been in work know that we're the brunt of jokes if we're the management. It's just the way it is. Right? Employees love to stick it to management. And they love it when they hear their boss being berated by the boss above them. There's just something about that as a person that we're like, yeah, they got what they deserved. Paul also knows that employers around the globe throughout history are the same. What boss doesn't want to get every cent of productivity out of his people? What boss doesn't want to make sure that they work you to the bone to get what they're paying you for? It's just the way it is, right? It's part of what happens in a work world. And Paul then says, okay, with these two kinds of things going on, understanding human nature, understanding this is an important place where you as a Christian live, let me talk about what it means to have a Spirit-filled life as you go into work. Now, some of you, I forget sometimes how many gray hairs I see. Some of you left the work world a long time ago, and you might be thinking, this doesn't apply to me. It does. It's the same type of thing that affects where you go volunteer, the kind of service you render to those that you volunteer your life for. It affects the kind of pattern that you set when you are working with other folks around you. They need to see these things too. So what does Paul want to say? What does God want to say to those of us who find ourselves as employees? Who find ourselves working for others, where we have a boss and it's our job to produce for them. Listen to what he says. Slaves, obey your earthly masters, just as you would obey Christ. Obey your earthly masters, just as you would obey Christ. That is the guiding principle of the entire passage. As you would do to Jesus, do it to your employer. As you would do to Jesus, do it to your employee. Let that guide the way that you live. Think about life as an act of worship. Your work as an act of worship. Obey them just as you would obey Jesus. Do the things that they want. The work of a slave, the work of an employee, is to be rendered in the name of the Lord. Should be no doubt in their mind that you are working for them because you're working for Jesus. Work is an expression of our Christian life. It's an expression of Christian service. Paul, in this passage in Ephesians, is challenging the sacred and the secular distinction. He's challenging that Sunday is a day that's different than Monday. And I don't know how many times I've heard that from people who say, I can't believe that that guy goes to church on Sunday. You would never know by the things that come out of his mouth on Monday. Or the way he treats people in the office on Tuesday. Paul's challenging that and saying, no, this shouldn't be, my brothers, my sisters. That when we work, it should be a reflection of who we are and our relationship with the Lord. So how is this work to be done? Paul gives us a couple of clues. He says, first, your work should be done with fear and respect. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear. Better translation would be with fear and trembling, quaking that person who's over you has the right to cut you off, to rid you from their employment. To remove you, right? It's a type of fear that shouldn't cause us to, it's not the kind of fear that you're like, oh my gosh, I can't ever say anything to this person. But it's the kind of fear that recognizes that this person has control over my life and the decisions they make will affect my future. It'll affect the course of the way my life is lived. Right? We should have a deep reverence for those who are our employers. Because they really do have an effect upon our life. We shouldn't treat them glibly. They have power over you. Paul says, just as you show deference to Jesus, whose decisions and his management and his plans for you will completely affect your life, show that same kind of deference to your employer. If he asks you to do something a certain way, do it that way. If he wants you to do something first every day, do it first every day. Even if it doesn't make sense to you, even if it's a better way that you think is your way, do it his way or her way. Paul also says that we should do that with sincerity of heart, right? That there should be a heart in us that really is engaged in it. I mean, imagine the kind of worship that you would have if you came to God on Sunday morning with fear and reverence, but your heart was disconnected. Is that worship? Is that the kind of life that God would be pleased with? That you just go through the motion of showing deference and being respectful, but inside, you're thinking, this is a waste of time. Why am I here? It's not sincerity of heart. Our work should be done not only with showing deference and respect to those who are over us, but also really truly caring about the work we're doing and caring about them and the effects that it has on life. We shouldn't pretend that we have respect for someone. And then as soon as they walk out, we demean them or we ridicule them or we make fun of them. This will tell you something about me, but my favorite comic is Dilbert. Why? Because Dilbert makes fun of the boss all the time. Sincerity in my own heart needs to be challenged a little bit. Now, that's not to say that Dilbert's not funny, right? But it does say something about my heart when that's my funniest comic. Right? Paul wants us to realize that the kind of attitude that Dilbert displays to his boss is not a kind of attitude that displays respect and fear and that displays a sincerity of heart for the kind of work that's done. Paul's condemning those behaviors because, as a heavenly people, we are called to so much more. We've been given so much more. We are to work as we worship, and we're to worship as we work. That's the kind of life that we're being called into. One where God is exalted in everything we think and say and do 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We're to obey them, those who are put over us. Listen to what he says in verse 6. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. He's almost repeating exactly what he said in verse 5. Again, just with a slightly different twist again. I love the words that he uses in Greek in this one because he talks about being a man pleaser and being an eye slave. He says, don't be a slave to somebody else's eyes when they're watching you. Be a slave all the time. Even when they're not watching you, be a slave. Don't be a person who, when the boss comes in, suddenly your productivity is twice as much as it was before. And as soon as the boss goes out, your productivity is bad. Even if that means you were more productive than everybody else around. But you somehow, the boss walks in and it forces you to kind of up the ante a little bit. Don't be that kind of person in your work. Be consistent all the way through, working hard, diligently, over and over, every moment of every day for them. He says, work hard, right? Serve wholeheartedly in verse 7, as if you were serving the Lord and not men. And I couldn't pick a passage any better if I wanted to say work is worship and worship is work. I mean, every verse Paul is saying, let me remind you how work is like worship. That you do this like you do it to the Lord. Wholehearted, complete, giving everything you've got, every activity, 9 to 5, is for the glory of God. Every bit of it. Now, why in the world would we want to work that way? Well, there's two reasons given in the passage. The first reason comes at the end of chapter 9, and it says, their master and yours. Right? We only have one master. Our master is not our employer. It's not anything else but the Lord. He's the one who has said, this is the work that I have for you, Scott. This is the work I have for you, Tricia. This is the work I have for you. Put in your name. We have one master, and so we serve him with everything we've got. The second reason he gives is in verse 8. Serve wholeheartedly because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he's a slave or a free. And we serve and we work that way because we recognize there is a reward that's coming and that's for us. And that's due us, and that will be given to us. A reward. I'm reminded of a story of Teddy Roosevelt and a missionary couple. Now, you guys know Teddy Roosevelt was the former president of the United States. He was kind of the quintessential man's man, right? And he took off at one point and headed to Africa on this giant, giant safari. And at the end of his safari, he came back to port, and I can't remember which U.S. port he came back into, but on the boat that he was on was a missionary couple finishing up 30 years of service in Africa. And as Teddy Roosevelt got off the boat, right, the pomp and the circumstance and the music is playing, and there's throngs of people at the port to welcome him home and to sing his praise because he shot some lions and some elephants, and I don't think there's bears in Africa, although that would be good too. And this poor missionary man was distraught. And he said, why did I just waste my life? Why did I go to Africa with my life to come home and there was nobody to welcome us? And we don't have a home to go to. And there was nobody to say, we're so glad you're back. And his wise wife said, why don't you go talk to God about that, honey? And so he did. And he went into his study and he studied, and a few hours later he came out just radiant. And you know what he heard from the Lord? You're not home yet. You haven't gotten your reward yet. But it's coming. We work this way because there's a reward that is waiting for us that will be filled with more pomp and more circumstance and more glory than we could ever imagine. That's why we work this way. That's why we see our daily life as an offering to the Lord. I love what 1 Peter says. Though you've not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and you're filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy, for you are receiving the goal of your faith, the salvation of your souls. And when we work like that, it's displaying that we really believe that we're getting the salvation of our souls at the end of the age. Now, there are some of us who have the job of overseeing other people. We're the masters. We're the owners. We're the employers, the bosses. And Paul, in like fashion, just like he's done with every one of these relationships, says, let me talk to you, too, about how you should manage, how you should treat those who are under your supervision. He says, and masters, treat your slaves in the same way. The same way. How's that? What is that? What is he referring to? Treat them in the same way, doing good to them, just like they're doing good to you. Treat them as though you're seeking to benefit them and to be about their needs and serving them. Because that's what he just told the employees to do. Work so that they, those employers, are benefited. So that they get everything they need. And now he's saying, employers, make sure you manage so that your employees are benefited. So that they get everything that they need. Seneca was a Roman philosopher. In one of his letters, he wrote to a friend about the slave issue, telling this guy that, hey, we have to treat our slaves differently. It's not to say that slavery was grand in the Roman Empire, right? The picture I painted at the front end, right? It was a caricature. Slavery's never a good thing. There's just no way you can do it. But it was different than the slavery in America. It had its problems. And Seneca outlines some of those problems. And he says, here's some of the problems that we as slave owners have with our slaves. One, we forbid them to speak. We won't let them talk. And two, we give them the crappiest work, the most menial jobs. And if I described the work that some of these slaves had to do, you would be repulsed. And so I won't describe it to you. And third, he says, we humiliate them. Now, if we're bosses, we could take to heart some of the things that Seneca said. Maybe as bosses, we need to open up and have a place for our employees to speak to us, to actually bring their thoughts and their ideas and to say, hey, what you're thinking here just isn't a good idea. That we could create an environment where our employees could speak to us out of respect, out of love, out of a diligent desire to still work hard, but that they could speak and say, hey, this isn't okay. We need to talk about this issue and find a resolution. Maybe we could also learn from Seneca and we could say, hey, as employers, we have a responsibility not to just hand the crappiest jobs off to the lowest guy on the totem pole. We have a Savior who said, right, you call me Lord, but look at what I'm here doing. I came as one to serve. I'm taking off my robe, and I'm washing your feet. A job reserved for some of the lowest of the low slaves. Maybe management as employers would be, hey, I'll do that junky job for you today. Maybe as management, we shouldn't humiliate those who work under us. It's so easy as management to pass the buck and to say it was their fault, isn't it? I was reading and I ran across a story of a TV exec who had trained up a protege. And one day, as the protege, she was a news anchor, and she royally screwed up on air in front of thousands and millions of people. And her boss was called in to give an account. What are you going to do? And we want that girl fired for what she did. And you know what most of us would do? We'd say, if they're going to fire her for that, okay, I'm going to stay out of this. You know what this guy did? He stepped forward and he said, you know what? It's my fault. I didn't train her well enough. And so I take every bit of responsibility, and if somebody needs to be fired, I'm the one who gets fired today. ABC, CBS, NBC, I can't remember which one it was, completely changed their tone and looked at that gentleman and said, oh, if it was your fault, we won't get rid of her. He stepped in the gap, right? Instead of humiliating this girl, he stepped in the gap and he took the responsibility so that she would be safe. Slaves, masters, treat your slaves in the same way, right? Seek their benefit. Step in the gap for them to make sure that they're protected. He goes on to say, don't threaten them. That's the easy thing to do as management, isn't it? That's the easy way to manage, is to threaten people. And to say, if you don't do this, you will. And certainly leaders have the right to threaten. And there's a time for it occasionally. And there's a place where it needs to be done. And they have the right to discipline. And they have the right to withhold blessing. And they have the right to chastise and to warn. All of those are well within the right of the manager. Paul's saying, don't always use that technique. Don't let that be your default, your fallback to. Remember the gospel? It's about love. It's about compassion. It's about mercy. It's far easier to threaten than it is to motivate and to encourage and to draw out the best of somebody. So learn to motivate. Find out what it is about your employees that you need to know so that they will be encouraged and built up and they'll want to give you more. I can't tell you how to do that. I never figured it out. I'm still learning. But go on the path. Ask them, what is it that motivates you? How could I encourage you? And you may be surprised. For some of them, it may just be as simple as, just tell me thank you. Just tell me thank you. And for others, it may be, show me the dough. If that's who it is, if that's what it is, then figure it out and do it. For me, that's what it was when I worked in business. My mind was entirely set on being a millionaire, like I said, by 30. I had the gall as a 24-year-old guy to sit across from my boss when he told me, okay, this is what I expect the first year. I expect you to make 6 times your annual salary. 6 to 8 is the window. I said, okay. When I came in at 25 years old, and I sat across from my boss and I said, I made 13 times my annual salary last year. I want my raise, I want my paycheck doubled next year. He choked and he swallowed and he looked at me and he said, okay. And the following year, I made 10 times my paycheck. And I demanded the same thing again. That's what motivated me at that time in my life. He understood me and he played into who I was so that I gave him every bit of what he deserved as an employer. He understood me. Know your people as managers. Know how to encourage them. Know how to draw them out. And I tell that story not to say, hey, church, you need to double my salary. Okay? Some of you are thinking, oh, crap. I don't tell that story to say that. God has taught me a different set of things that motivate me now than what motivated me then. It's not to say money's not an enjoyable thing. But know your people. Know how to encourage them. Know how to draw them out. Why? Because he who is both your master is also theirs. And there's no favoritism with him, Paul says. We have the same Lord who will judge us. He doesn't look and say, oh, you are management and you are workers. We got to cut the workers' slack and we're hard on the management, or vice versa. He doesn't show any of that. He just says, did your life display the life of Jesus? Did you work like you were working for Jesus? Did you manage like you were managing for Jesus? That's what he says. God will not excuse us because we think that we're special or important. It's the same standard. And that's why every one of us needs to come to the communion table, isn't it? Because that standard is so tall and so high that none of us can ever get there 100% of the time, every day of our life. So whether you're wondering, hey, I want to be a spirit-filled person in life, study the gospel, study Jesus, and find it. And when you don't live up, come to the table and remember the gift. If you want to be a manager, do the same thing. Study the gospel. Look at the Beatitudes. And when you study it and you say, I can't do that all the time, come to the table and enjoy the gift. Jesus never turns anybody away who earnestly wants to come and be fed and transformed and changed, whether they're a husband or a child or a father or a worker or a boss. Holy Father, we thank you that in Christ we have been given a picture of what it means to bring every area of life under your authority and your sway. Lord, help us to go forth tomorrow morning remembering the table, remembering the gift, so that we can be a blessing to those whom we work with and whom we serve. And all God's people said, amen. The elders come forward.